Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 42 of Game On with Cody and John. On this episode's big deal, the Great Debate. We'll take a look at the difference between great games and fun games. Is there a difference? And on this episode's Buy, Try, or Deny,
Mystery Express.
Will you buy a first-class ticket or throw yourself from the train?
All this and much more on Game On with Cody and John.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, role-playing games, miniatures, war games, all kinds of great stuff, coming to you from beautiful Indianapolis, Indiana.
It's been a while.
It has. I feel like it's been about, three and a half, 4 weeks since I've
recorded.
And spring has sprung here in Indianapolis, and I just got back from some vacation time. And so thanks so much for being patient listeners and waiting for a little bit of a delay on this episode, but we're all raring to go to get back under the microphones and bring you some great gaming content. Cody, what do we got going on this episode?
All right, well, we've got a great big deal where some listeners have written in, and we've kind of had this in the hopper for a while, talking about great games versus fun games. Are they one and the same? Are they two totally different categories? We're going to talk about it and kind of put some of the what we consider great games, if they're any fun.
Yeah, or fun games if they're great. So,
that's right.
So yeah, we'll be discussing that. And then on our Buy, Try, or Deny, we're going to be talking about the new hotness, as we tend to do.
That's right.
From Days of Wonder, Mystery Express. Yeah. I think last episode we said we were going to be talking about Summoner Wars, and we just might.
Ooh, stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
That was a tease.
Yeah, but our Buy, Try, or Deny will be about Mystery Express, this sort of sleuthing, deduction sort of game from Days of Wonder.
I've really been looking forward to this for like about 4 to 5 months now. I've been really raring to go.
All right, well, we'll get to see what Cody thought about it as well as me. But as always, we're going to start off this episode with the Game On Inbox, which starts
now. The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it. All right, it is time for the Game On Inbox. And before we get too deep into it, John is going to tell you the latest news from our sponsor, Myriad Games.
Well, as you may or may not know, Game On with Cody and John is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. And we love Dan and Sarah and their great awesomeness in gaming. And
great awesomeness.
Yeah, what can I say? And we also want to say congratulations to Dan and Sarah, who have just welcomed their new baby boy, Logan Xavier, into the world. So another,
congrats.
Another X-Man, I guess. Or professor, I guess. Whatever.
He's going to love that.
Yeah, well, anyway. So it's a good gaming name, what can I say?
Whether LXY.
Whether it was intentional or not. So congratulations to Dan and Sarah. And we want to tell you a little bit more about the Myriad Games Game Share Program. This is a new thing that they've started at if you're a MVP member, which is a kind of a tiered membership thing where you can sign up at certain levels and money will be taken out of your account, and that will turn into Myriad money that's you can spend in the store there. But if you join at certain levels, then you get access to this game share program, which is kind of like Netflix for games. And they have a huge game library that you can select from, and they will, if you're local, you can go in and just check these games out, and if you like them, you can purchase them. And if you decide you don't want to buy it, you can just bring it back, just like a library book kind of a thing. We have been participating in this from a remote location here in the gaming capital of the world, where Dan's been shipping us some games. And one of the games is Mystery Express, which is the game we're going to be talking about in Buy, Try, or Deny. So, and just to, not to give away too much about what I thought of the game, but after getting it in the game share program, I actually decided to go ahead and purchase it. And so that transaction was really easy, and it just gave me an opportunity to check it out before I bought it. So really good program there, real innovative, and we'd encourage you guys to check it out and check out other stuff at myriadgames.com.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's move on to the first part of the Game One Inbox, which is, you know, it's been a while, so we've got probably a little bit to talk about here, and that's games we've been playing. So, Cody, what have you been playing last few weeks?
A few weeks ago, I went to a kind of a gaming meetup where we played all sorts of different things. Played Fury of Dracula, one of my favorite games.
Were you Dracula?
I was Dracula.
Are you ever not Dracula?
No, I'm usually Dracula. But... And I've had kind of a Dracula losing streak lately. I used to be where I was untouchable at this game. I was really, really good at it. And it's the last few times we've played, I've gotten cards like... The Hunters have gotten cards like newspaper reports on the second turn and just revealing where I am pretty much right from the get-go. So it's been rough. So we played again. I was looking to kind of reverse the curse. And second turn, newspaper reports again. Yeah.
It's time to step it up.
Yeah.
You got to step up your game here.
But the thing is, I managed to get enough new vampires and evade myself around, and I didn't get the Dracula teleport card. I forget what it's called, but I was one turn away from victory.
Oh, so it still made it close. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was going to ask you, do you think that card is broken if it comes out too early in the game?
It can be, but there's enough options to where a semi-good Dracula player can kind of... you know, evade the Hunters well enough.
Okay.
But let's see, played some of that, played Dominion a little bit, and we've been playing some War Machine whenever we can get it in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
we both got a nice little shipment of War Machine figures in, and I've gotten quite a bit of little units from Myriad Games.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Been working on painting those up.
Dan's been our dealer in more ways than one.
That's right. And then along with Mystery Express, we also played a new game from Mayfair, Nuns on the Run.
Nuns on the Run.
That got sung about Nuns 80 times during the game.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's a fun game. And we're going to actually be talking about that a little bit next episode, so stay tuned for that. I think that's everything. That was a long stretch of game. Long stretch of time.
Now what about RPGs? Have you been doing any RPG stuff
lately?
Oh,
yeah. I'm still doing the fourth edition game. We've started Paragon tier, which is kind of like that middle tier of it. It's good. I'm starting to see where people are saying that, like, starting with Paragon tier, the combats get really long, because we're a pretty efficient group as far as knowing what we're doing, and we're still getting like hour and a half long combats.
Wow.
So I mean, we'll see. But
how many players again? How many players?
Between 5 and 6 every night. So average size.
That's still long.
Wow. Yeah, that's still way too long. But that campaign's going to be going on for a few more months, and then I'm going to turn the reins over to Kaylin so she can run her Pathfinder game.
Oh, she's still going to do that. Great.
She's still going to do that. And I've actually been playing in a Castles and Crusades game. I don't know if I've mentioned it on the show. It's kind of a retro clone, as it's called. It uses the newer D20 system, but it actually plays a lot like first edition D&D, which I played a lot of. And it is a lot of fun. It's just kind of this old school feel with it, but it's got new mechanics. There's new material coming out for it. So it's kind of a small publisher game, a Trolllord Games based out of Arkansas.
Wow.
Not the first state, not the 15th state you think of for RPG players. But,
no.
but it is a lot of fun. So I'm going to be getting into more of that, and I might DM it at one point. Who knows?
Exciting. Okay. Well, very good. Well, as far as games that I've been playing, I actually have been on vacation quite a bit lately. Spent almost a week in Washington, D.C. with the family, going and seeing all the museums and the monuments and that kind of stuff during the Cherry Blossom Festival. Very exciting. But whenever I travel, I tend to want to go and check out to see what local game stores might be around. So I looked up on the interwebs and found a store in Chantilly, Virginia.
The Old Dominion.
Very good. Yes, the Old Dominion. How did you know that?
let's not discuss.
This is amazing. And found out the store called the Game Parlor. And I guess they have two locations, one in Chantilly, Virginia, and one in Woodbridge, Virginia.
Beautiful Woodbridge, Virginia.
Yeah. And it was pouring down rain, but my father-in-law and I, we actually went out and checked this game store out one evening and found they had a really great selection. I was really impressed. They had just a little group of folks playing. I think they were playing Age of Empires 3 in the back.
Oh.
That board game. And they had a really good selection of all kinds of stuff. They actually organized their store a little differently than I've ever seen. Is they organized it by theme almost. So they had like kind
really?
Of a horror section that had horror RPGs and board games, and they had a war game section with all kinds of war games. And it was
interesting.
It was I couldn't decide whether I liked it or not.
Yeah, but I'm kind of in the same boat. That's interesting.
Because if you were looking for something specific, I don't know if that would be more difficult to find. But spoke to the the purveyor that was in there, a guy named Lee Garvin.
The purveyor.
I don't know if he was the owner of the
peddler.
The gentleman who was behind the counter. And his name was Lee Garvin. And he talked with him, and it was real nice chatting with him about just games in general and also about his store. And he said that he is actually going to be at Gen Con this year with a company called Skirmisher Publishing. Hmm. And he's been working on some different RPG books. He mentioned one called The Noble Wild, which is a book about role-playing animals. And not just like anthropomorphic animals, but actually animals themselves. So that sounds very interesting. I've never heard of anything like that. So anyway, so if you happen to live in the Northern Virginia area, I would recommend going and checking out the Game Parlor, because it looks like it's a pretty cool store. I actually picked up a new Warcaster for War Machine while I was there. I figured, you know, gotta
feed the habit.
Exactly. You know, but it was only like $10, so that's helpful. Didn't come back with anything too expensive there, but I had a great time with that. And also went on another trip just this past weekend to Dallas, Texas. I took my wife to see Bon Jovi in concert in Dallas.
Bon Jovi, sure.
Bon Jovi. My wife is a huge Bon Jovi fan, so we had a great time at the concert. But my played some games with my stepmom while I was there, and she's big into all kinds of games, and needed something that could fit on the plane in the carry-on bag. So I picked up two small dice games out of my collection and tried those out for the first time. We played a game called Roll Through the Ages and another one called To Court the King. And I think these are both really good games. You know, we may take a closer look at them a little bit later. Cody hasn't had a chance to play them yet, have you? Okay.
No, they sound fun.
Yeah.
Dice.
Well, To Court the King, I think, is very cool because it has sort of a Yahtzee-ish mechanic. Both these games have the Yahtzee, roll your dice, set some aside, roll again, set some aside, roll again, and then, you know, and then do something with those dice. In To Court the King, you're using these dice and getting certain numbers of pips and combinations to be able to claim cards that represent members of the court, like, you know, the magician, the apprentice, the farmer, that kind of stuff. And by gaining those cards, that will allow you to do – each card has a certain ability on it that will allow you to bring in more dice or possibly change the face of certain dice, with the idea being that you eventually want to get seven of a kind. And when you roll seven of a kind, that sort of triggers the end game, because you're going to claim the king card, the king and the queen card. And then everybody basically gets one more roll after that to see if they can beat your seven of a kind. And they might be able to, you know, depending on what cards they have, they might be able to roll eight of a kind. So there's a little bit of strategy to it of you need to be able to roll your dice and then figure out how to utilize your cards to make the dice do what you want them to do. So it's a very interesting game, I think, and I think it's designed by Tom Lehman, who I want to say he was the guy who designed Race for the Galaxy. So that game, and then Roll Through the Ages, which is sort of a dice. It's got the same sort of theme as Through the Ages, the Civilization card game, but other than just the theme sort of pasted on, it's a very different sort of game. But you're rolling dice for resources that you're going to spend to be able to build things that you're kind of checking off on this score sheet. And I thought that game was a lot of fun too, so you know, I'll have to play that one. It's one that you can pull out and play in probably half an hour. It's got some good little strategy to it, but I think the fact that it's quick is good, because if it was like a 2-hour game, I think that'd be a little bit bit too much. But a nice quick dice rolling game, good components too. It's got like these nice wooden scoring things.
Oh yeah, I've seen those. It's pretty slick,
big wooden dice and that kind of stuff. So that's pretty cool. We played a lot of War Machine, like Cody said, and I've been trying to get all of my stuff that's currently assembled, trying to get it all painted, so that I also have some other new things that I purchased that I need to get assembled. But slowly building that Menoth army, and I'm hoping to be able to, you know, play more with Cody and with some of my other friends, and getting ready for Gen Con. I think might try an event at Gen Con with that. So
good luck.
Thanks. And speaking of that, just kind of going into maybe some news here, most of our news this time has to do with conventions.
Yeah.
And so, Cody, you wanted to tell us a little bit about Origins?
Yeah. Origins has kind of had a fun little off season here. They've had website issues and registration issues and registration.
What? An angry mob of fans who on their Facebook page who think the world's coming to an end.
Yep. Apparently registration has gone live for it. Which is good, you know, a few months before.
The online registration. Because before they were making you like...
It was old school. It was like 80s Gen Con.
Yeah,
you
print
know?
Out a PDF or something and, you know, fill it out and send it in.
Yeah. There has been... I've heard some concern because a lot of the transaction fees have been passed on to you, the customer. So you may be paying a little more for the privilege of registering online. So beware of that. But the fact it's online, I guess, is a small miracle in and of itself.
Yeah. But yeah, Origins is a really good convention. It's, you know, slightly smaller than Gen Con and seems to have maybe a little bit more of a board game focus. Mm-hmm. And we've talked before about the boardroom that Columbus Area Board Gaming Society puts on. So I know that our plans currently is, I know I will definitely be at Origins, and I think you're still kind of a maybe. I'm not sure.
I do not think I will be making it this
year. Oh, okay. So it might just be me.
Apologies.
So if you happen to see me in my Game On shirt while you're at Origins, then come on up. I think one thing is the Dice Tower podcast puts together this sort of wits and wagers game show sort of a thing in the boardroom. And I think I'm going to be helping Eric Summerer out with that.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So that should be a lot of fun. So, if you're coming to Origins, be sure to get that boardroom ribbon and come and say hi.
Yeah. It's talking about registering for events. I've only been to Origins a few times, Gen Con's kind of my main convention, but I don't see the need to really register for a lot. If you're a board game fan, it's just like
just get the boardroom ribbon. Yeah, you'll play so many board games that you've never played before. It'll be great. So.
Yeah, and just buy it on site. You shouldn't need to pre-reg for it.
Yeah, but if you're an RPGer, there's still plenty to do there as well. So there's lots of events going on.
There's a lot of organized play stuff. I know RPGA has a pretty good presence. Pathfinder Society is getting up there. So check it out. Now, Gen Con, they had their annual registration hootenanny.
That's right. Every year, the event registration goes live, and then approximately 14 minutes after that, you get on the community forums.
Yeah. 14 seconds after that.
You get, a whole bunch of threads of people that are irritated with how slow it is and how their computer's crashing and how I'm an IT professional and if you just hired me, I could have fixed the whole thing and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But, it happened as always. But for those of you who weren't in front of your computers on April the 11th at noon Eastern Daylight Time, then you may not have gotten, you may not be able to get your tickets at this point. But things like True Dungeon, I've already sold out. Uh-huh. But there's still a lot of great events available. So if you're still planning on coming to Gen Con, I think you have until something like June the 19th or something like that. It's like the middle of June to do that online pre-registration.
Yeah, and I definitely recommend that. And I'm also very much in the ship to me camp. I think, a lot of people do the will call. I just get it all shipped to you. That way you don't have to wait because the will call lines can get pretty hairy, even on Wednesday.
Yeah.
They can get pretty hairy. So.
Cody has made me a believer in that. So I've selected the ship to me option as well this year.
Yeah. And we actually both got into True Dungeon this year.
That's right. Yep. And I had this sort of idea a few months ago that I kind of was volleying around of doing a True Dungeon run and trying to do like a podcaster's True Dungeon run.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've contacted the folks at the D6 Generation podcast, Russ, Craig, and Rafe, and also our friends at Myriad Games, Dan and Sarah Yerrington. And we're kind of putting this all together. It's still sort of tentative. I've definitely reserved and bought the tickets for a particular True Dungeon run. And we've got, some commitments and some folks trying to get their schedules all worked out. But we'll definitely have a run with Cody and I and some other gaming podcasters. And, we plan on doing a little bit of interviewing before and after and maybe do at least one recording in the middle of the dungeon.
Maybe. There's so many new people. I kind of want them just to soak it in because your first time is just – I don't want to say overwhelmed, but you're just kind of so amazed by the whole thing.
Yeah, we don't want to overdo it, but we gave you that back in our True Realm episode. we did a little bit of that, so it should be a lot of fun. So we'll bring you guys some content from that, and hope maybe the D6G guys and Dan and Sarah might be able to provide some content too. But we definitely want you to know that if you come to Gen Con and you're able to do True Dungeon, you should because it's a whole ton of fun.
Yeah, and. And not to dwell too much on it, but your chances greatly improve if there's just one or maybe two of you, because you can get the value of a True Dungeon ticket in generics, and they usually have a standby area. So if someone doesn't show up or someone needs one person, you can jump in, and you're running with strangers, but sometimes that can work out. I mean, if you just want to experience the event, that's not a bad option. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, because getting that whole block of tickets, I was, you know, sweating bullets for about a half an hour, you know, entering in codes, trying to find, you know, one block where you could get all 8 tickets. But finally got it. So I'm excited about that. I also signed up for a couple of demos, like the Malifaux miniatures game, which I've heard of on several podcasts.
I'm already making fun of him. Like,
I know, you know, once you kind of get bit by that miniatures bug, it's, you know, you enjoy that gameplay. So I'm gonna go and check out the Malifaux demo. There's one of those playing, and I've also decided to play in a Descent Sea of Blood game because just started a campaign for the Road to Legend, and of course Descent's one of my favorite games. But I wanted to try out this new campaign thing with the, you know, pirate ships and sea battles and that kind of stuff. So I'll be doing that as well at Gen Con. So
yeah, I didn't sign up for much. I signed up for. John's gonna laugh at me now. There's a Looney Labs room, kind of like the Big Experiment at Origins.
Uh-huh.
I think it's on a smaller scale. It's the Tiki Room. So I'm getting that ribbon just because Looney Labs game is fun, and if I've got time to kill, I can go in there and play something light.
And knock back a few.
Knock back a few.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, and then Sunday, I happened to just find this flipping through. Out of the Box Games, our good friends at Out of the Box Games, are hosting a Harry's Grand Slam Baseball tournament.
What time is that at? Because I might have to sign up for
that. It's like 11 a.m. on Sunday, I think.
Oh, that sounds pretty
cool. You need
to
be in it. So that game's a hoot, so I signed up for that. And then I might just, you know, I'll do probably a lot of demos in the exhibit hall.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of found now, and this isn't even a plug for Myriad, but I found that with that membership and everything, my days of doing big purchases at the cons has kind of waned.
Yeah.
Because even with RPGs, you know, I used to just try and buy all these books, and now I've limited my systems that I'm willing, you know, that I've tried or be willing to try. So I just kind of go around and do the demo scene and maybe pick up a few novelty type stuff. But
yeah,
you know, my days of dropping $300-$400 at the con is kind of gone away.
I definitely hope that my days of dropping $300-$400 at the con have gone away, because that just kills me every year.
Yeah.
I go in saying I'm only going to spend this, and then you see the coolness, you know. But yeah, I think this year I'm going to be a lot more deliberate about what we've talked about before, making a purchase a big deal.
Absolutely.
You know, that we, you know, we don't live in a time where you can just frivolously just go and buy whatever you want. You know, well, at least I can't.
Yeah.
And so it's good to make it a big deal. Also, just one last thing about Gen Con, there's also going to be a lot of, if you're interested in podcasting or you like, you know, gaming podcasts, and we know that a lot of folks that listen to Game On with Cody and John also listen to a lot of other shows, I know that I do, then you can come and learn more about podcasting and meet your favorite podcasters. There's a whole track of seminars at Gen Con, and a lot of them are being put on by Gamesalute.com. And, you know, so it's things like, you know, you can meet the Pulp Gamer Media Network podcasters. There's things on new board and card games. There's I'm going to be on a panel that's about podcasting gear and software and that kind of stuff. So
there's a really cool media meet and greet that's Saturday night at this kind of makeshift bar that they put up in Indianapolis called The House.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty cool. So, like I said, we love meeting listeners. That's one of the big perks of the job. And we'll be sporting those bowling shirts.
Yep. And so we'll bring you more information as we get closer to Gen Con on the specifics of those seminars and which things we'll be at. So we look forward to seeing you guys at Gen Con. One last piece of news about convention stuff, and that is about another convention coming up in November, and that's Board Game Geek Con, or BGG.con, that is put on by Board Game Geek, the largest and most comprehensive board game website in the history of board game websites. And they have a convention every year in November that is at a hotel in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I just read on Board Game Geek that the registration for that, which has been live for a little while now, that they are 3/5 full, like 60% full. And this is a con that does sell out usually. And, you know, so if you're interested in going to this great convention, which is mostly like open gaming, board gaming stuff, there's a huge game library that's there. And there's also a lot of folks that go to Essen, the large convention in Germany, and bring back those new releases from Essen and have those available for play. So that's a good opportunity there. But if you want to be a part of that, then I would encourage you to go to BoardGameGeek.com and go ahead and get your badge now.
And you're going to be there.
I will be there. Yeah, this is a kind of convention year for me,
yeah.
I guess. But I grew up in the Dallas area, so I'll have a free lodging, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I'll be at that convention as well. So I hope to see some listeners there as well. Is that what we got for news?
I think so.
Okay.
Now, well, we had a contest.
We did.
And I think the good people out there want to know the results of that contest.
Indeed. And before we talk about the different entries into this particular contest, I want to mention that our last contest that we had where we gave away some copies of Say Anything and we sort of pulled out our new piece of technology, the Game On voicemail box. And we had a lot of great response on that. And what I noticed is that after we recorded the last episode and gave away those games, that we had several entries after that. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize that sometimes when we do contests, we don't do a real good job of giving an end date for when's the last time that you can enter. So for those of you who kind of got in after we, you know, recorded, and do apologize for that. And for future contests, starting with whatever our next one is, we will make sure to give you an exact end date or a deadline for when you can enter. So we've had about 3 weeks of soak time, if you will, for the for this War Machine contest. And so we're going to go ahead and give away our Ironclad Warjack today. And so we had a lot of good responses in the Game On voicemail box about miniatures wargaming. What we suspected was that there were folks out there that were a lot like us that were hesitant to get involved in miniatures wargaming, but that, you know, after hearing about War Machine, maybe they would be interested in it. So here are some of the responses that we got in our voicemail box about War Machine.
Hey, Cody and John, this is Morgan Merchant from Bristol, Indiana. Hey, I just wanted to enter the contest with the War Machine. I have been interested in War Machine. I've seen it played at conventions, but it has always scared me, the initial cost. But after listening to you guys talk, this actually might be something that I could get involved in. Hey, I really appreciate the show. Thank you so much. Bye.
Hi, Cody and John. This is Ken from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I thought I'd let you know about my miniatures experience. I own quite a bit of Warhammer 40K Space Marines that I've never, ever seen a table. Some of them are painted, most of them are not. I'm interested in getting into War Machine because it seems like it's a much smaller model and therefore dollar count. I've heard lots and lots of good things about the rules, whereas Games Workshop seems to ignore playability sometimes, despite the fact they have fantastic fluff. And between the guys at D6 Generation and you two getting into it, I thought, you know, this might be a really good thing to try. So again, just calling in and letting you know that that's where I'm aiming for. Keep up the good work. Love listening to your podcast. Bye.
Hey, Cody and John, this is Ned Lessingwell from Shreveport, Louisiana. Just wanted to share my opinion of miniatures games. One thing that's kept me away from them for a while has been just the price of getting into it. It does cost a lot of money to get all those figures. But lately, I actually have been getting into miniatures. And one thing that got me back into them was the versatility of miniatures games. You know, once you get that figure, you can paint it any way you want, and you can actually use your figures you can design your own scenarios and actually use them with different rule systems. And actually your review of War Machine got me kind of interested in it, since the buy-in seems a little bit lower than some other miniature systems. So can't wait for the next show. Thanks. Bye.
Hey guys, Paul from Calgary calling in about your latest episode on War Machine. Specifically, my son, who was sitting in the back seat and is a HeroScape fanatic, was quite intrigued by the idea of War Machine, and as such, made me promise to call in and throw in an entry. So keep up the good work. He would like to consider moving up from HeroScape to, I guess, a more pure miniatures game. So that's what we're after. Thanks.
Hey guys, my name is Josiah, and I'm calling from beautiful Dallas-Fort Worth, and I just listened to your episode about War Machine, and I am interested in that little unit you're giving out. I got into miniatures wargaming far too young. I say got into it. My dad tried to get me into it, but that didn't happen. I was far too young to understand Warhammer 40K, and it burned me on the whole hobby. Since then, I have cast it aside as any part of gaming in my life. So listen to your episode. It actually got me interested again, and I have the added benefit of a friend who I know I can sucker into getting into it with me. So it'd be great if I could take that and get it started. Thanks, guys. Love the show.
Hello, Cody and John. It's Alan from the cornfields of Southern Illinois. You'd asked about what our preconceived notions about minis were and why we might think about getting into them. And mine, pretty close to what you talked about, cost. I only knew about Warhammer, and I knew you needed tons and tons of figures that were fairly pricey and hard to get, at least for me. And secondly, just the thought of painting tons and tons of miniatures. I'm not an artist by any stretch, and it really wasn't something I was looking forward to trying. But between you guys and the D6G talking about War Machine and Hordes, because they don't take very many miniatures, and Monsterpocalypse, because the miniatures are already painted, I've actually picked up some Monsterpocalypse stuff and kind of messing around with it and think it'll be interesting and maybe something I can get my girls interested in, too. So just wanted to call and give you some feedback. I love the show, and you guys are doing a great job. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Hey, John. Hey, Cody. This is Stefan Rothschuh calling from Germany. I'm a Celtic Joker on Board Game Geek. I'm a longtime listener of your show, and the timing of your War Machine episode could not have been better, as we'll see later. You're asking about our preconceptions about miniatures, gamers, and the painting stuff and all that. And, well, let me tell you mine, my take on the whole thing. I consider myself, I guess, a common gamer, just as you guys. I play mostly board and card games and the occasional collectible game, Magic and Dreamblade and the like. And, well, I've always thought that miniatures, gamers, those Warhammer players and all those people were, I don't know, maybe a little weird or, well, let's just say I was a little hesitant about that whole area of our hobby. And, my preconceptions about the whole genre changed about a month or two ago, and it all started with my favorite game, Descent. I started a Road to Legend campaign with two friends of mine, and as we were playing the Overlord, and even we, the hero players, kept confusing Vyra the Falconer and Ronan of the Wild on the board. The two hero miniatures have sort of similar swishing cloaks and a sword in hand, and so once in a while we would pick the wrong guy and the Overlord would shoot the wrong guy or something like that. So I thought, yeah, maybe I'll just mark their bases in two different colors or something similar, quick and easy. And then I browsed through my wife's arts and crafts supplies box, and I found a surprising number of paints and even very small brushes there. So then I figured, okay, maybe I'll paint the guys' cloaks as well as their bases. But then that looked kind of incomplete, too, and, well, I ended up painting them completely. And before I knew it, I had bought more paints, primer, washes, and varnish from my local gaming store. And by now I've painted the other two heroes as well and some 10 or 12 monsters to boot. So, well, it turns out that I really enjoy this painting. I would have never thought it because I don't consider myself much of an artistic person. But I really get a kick out of the sense of achievement, I guess, from seeing a completely painted model, and they just look so much cooler on the board, too. The second nudge in the miniatures gaming and painting direction came from, well, the D6 generation. Their enthusiasm for miniatures games and also their great painting tips really got me hooked on the whole thing, and to the point that I actually considered getting into War Machine, although right now I've got my eyes on Grind, a game also by Privateer Press. You might want to check that out because it's a board game set in the War Machine universe, and it uses similar Steamjack models, and it's sort of a football kind of Blood Bowl-ish thing where two teams of Steamjacks push a ball around and try to score goals. Anyway, so, I hope I'm in with a chance for that cool Steamjack or Warjack you're giving away because, as I said, I really enjoy the painting and especially the War Machine system and the looks of their models. I think they're very, very cool. as compared to other Warhammer or similar things. Well, that's my story, and keep up the good work, and I'm looking forward to your next show. Goodbye.
Hey, Cody and John. My name's Lee. I'm from Denver, Colorado. Used to be big into the Mark I version of War Machine back up until it kind of became Infantry Machine, where the infantry became really powerful. Sold off all of my stuff, but recently as a gift got the Mark II rulebook and have been looking through my friend's Signar, Forces of Signar book, and have really decided that instead of going with the Mercenaries, which was what I used to play, that I think I'm going to kick off a Signar force. So I think that would be a crowning piece into a start towards an army. And thanks for the great podcast, guys. Keep it up, and love to listen to you guys. Bye.
All right, so thanks so much for all those folks who called in to talk to us about War Machine. And we were right. A lot of folks that, you know, a lot of those calls were just like, oh, I was thinking about getting into it, but then I, you know, mm-hmm. They're probably just trying to curry favor so that we'll give them the.
I did like the call where he's like, I've got a friend I can sucker into this.
Yeah.
Because, like we said, that is so important.
That is. If you can sucker someone else into it, then you're halfway there, really. Right. So anyway, we ended up, I don't know if you were counting at home there, but we had 8 entries to the contest there.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks so much for those. And we already did our die roll off mic here.
We are an Ameritrash podcast.
Exactly. So we did a D8 roll. And Cody, who is our big winner?
It is Ned Leffingwell.
From Shreveport, Louisiana.
The Pelican State.
You looked that up, didn't you?
I thought it was the Creole State, and that's an unofficial one. So
okay,
half credit.
Good job there.
Thank you.
So Ned, thanks so much for calling in, and we
well done.
Like for you, yeah, well done. Good job. Yeah. And so we're going to be sending out the Ironclad Warjack to you. And what we need you to do, Ned, is to please write us at the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Yep, and give us your mailing address, and we will get that figure out to you. So thanks so much for everybody who called in. And I'm just loving the Game On voicemail box.
Yeah, even when we're not having a contest, folks, feel free to call in and give us ideas or just chat.
Yeah, and we'll devote a section of our Game On Inbox to voicemails and, you know, just play some of the ones that we've gotten.
Now, what is that number again?
That is 4138 Game On. 4138-426-3666.
Call today.
That's right. Call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We will not answer, but no. The voicemail will.
That's right.
So and you might hear yourself on the show. All right. So that, I believe, is the Game On Inbox.
That is it.
All right. Well, let's move on to our big deal. We're going to be talking about this big debate between great versus fun.
Whoa.
What?
It's time for a Game On bonus review. Bonus review. Bonus review. Bonus review.
Yes, indeed, another Game On bonus review. We told you that we would be talking about Summoner Wars,
yep.
And we will. So,
absolutely.
So, Cody has played Summoner Wars quite a few more times than I have, and so I'm going to kick it over to him for a little bit of the distilled rules rundown.
Right, this will not be the John Richard very well-crafted rules rundown. This will be the Cody Jones, I hope I don't forget all of the rules rundown for you.
Right, so don't like listen to this in hopes that you'll get all the nuances
yeah.
of the rules, but you should get the overview, right?
It's pretty easy.
Yeah, go for it.
Summoner Wars is a 2-4 player, actually 2 or 4, I would say, player card game that kind of mixes a little bit from the CCG aspect and a lot from the kind of miniatures war game rules, but it's all done with cards. So when you buy a box of it, you'll get 2 factions, and the 2 boxes they currently have are the Phoenix Elves versus the Tundra Orcs and the Cave Goblins versus the Guild Dwarves.
Oh, very good. You remembered that just off the top of your head.
I did.
Very well done.
Thank you. If you were to get both boxes, you can trade out your opponents. You know, like the Elves don't have to fight the Orcs exclusively. It's meant so as the game grows, you can pretty much just take any faction versus any other faction. They're balanced against each other.
But if you buy one box, you have enough to play a
absolutely.
Full game,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So one box, which I believe retails for about $24.95, I think.
Okay.
I'm just going to go off that. And you can get
could
that.
Be $100. We don't know.
It's a $500 game. And you can get that through your friendly professional game store or Plaid Hat Games. they are the ones who made this. I believe this is their first foray into games.
That's right. And the guy who designed this game and is sort of the owner of or leader or commissar of Plaid Hat Games is Colby Dotch, I believe is his name. And he is one of the founders of Heroescapers.com. So big into the Heroescape gaming. And you can sort of see that influence of, you know, that kind of game into this game. So
yeah, one of the nice things is it's rules light, but there's still a lot of strategy involved. In your deck, you're going to have a setup card, because you'll always set up in the same kind of formation at the beginning of the game, and then after that you can kind of expand from there. You'll have I call them creature cards, you know, which can be, there are common ones, which are like your grunts, and then you have champions, which are kind of higher up units. You have your summoner, which is you have one summoner that's the leader of your army, and a lot like War Machine, if that summoner is killed, then you lose. So
it's kind of like your Warcaster.
Yeah, so it's not just completely wipe out the other guy, though it's encouraged. If you can kill their summoner, then you win. There are also other cards called event cards, which are, you know, kind of like instants or sorceries, if you were to compare it to Magic or things like that. There are wall cards, which I'll get into in a minute. And that makes up the bulk of your deck. I believe each deck is 30 cards. So you've got a nice little bit, and there's going to be future options for customization. Now, it's not going to go the complete CCG route, because I believe they're going to have certain requirements in each deck. So you maybe will be able to customize, from what I've read, probably no more than a third of it, I would say, just roughly looking at it. So it won't turn too many people off with the, you know, the deck building and the winning the game by building the winning deck. You know,
it seems pretty self-contained.
Yeah. And as gameplay goes, you're going to you'll be able to summon more units to the battlefield, and this is kind of a neat mechanic. Each creature that you summon will have a summoning cost. And you can get those magic points one of two ways. You can get them by sacrificing your own cards, but the preferred way to do it is by killing your opponent's units. So say I kill one of John's orcs.
How dare you?
I know. Instead of him discarding that, that goes on top of my magic pile. So not only have I kind of weakened his forces, I can use that defeated unit to summon more for me.
And these cards have different backs to them, right? So different colors. So you even though things are going into other people's piles, you'll be able to sort it out at the end of the
game. Right. And I do suggest sleeving them. I mean, clear backed. But, you know, I've played six or seven games with mine. I was starting to see some wear already, so I went ahead and just sleeved them. And then the other way you can build magic is, like I said, sacrificing your own deck. Now, unlike mini games, when you go through your deck, you usually reshuffle. Once you go through your deck in this, you're done. So you don't really want to just be burning cards in your magic pool. You want to really be focused on killing your opponent, getting his units off the board, and getting your magic pool up.
Does this game have a board?
Oh, it's got a play mat. And this is kind of, I don't want to say a fiddly bit, but it's this kind of heavy stock folded paper mat that's kind of a pain to get completely flat.
Uh-huh.
I've seen where people have mounted it or kind of made their own, which is pretty cool. And I think they're going to be coming out with a deluxe playmat or something to that effect. But
it's just like white paper.
Yeah, right? It's functional. It's not bad. It's just kind of it takes a few plays and some reverse folding to get it flat enough to where your guys aren't sliding down hills.
It's terrain. It's just built in terrain.
Yeah.
So how does a game turn work?
Well, the first thing you're going to do is draw up to five cards, if you don't already have five cards in your hand. The second step is summoning. Now, I mentioned the walls earlier. Walls are just kind of these cards that, you know, they act as a wall, but they're also kind of your focus points for summoning. So you have to summon new creatures orthogonally to this wall. So that's something to keep in mind throughout the whole game. Movement, attacking, summoning. There are no diagonals. Everything has to be either just horizontal or vertical.
Okay.
So you can summon. Again, like I mentioned earlier, you'll pay for that using your magic pool, which is either cards you've discarded or creatures you've killed. After that, you can play event cards. Like I said, those are the sorcery or instant cards. You can also play walls during this period. They're counted as event cards. And then you have movement. You can move up to three units, up to two spaces. So you kind of pick the three, you move them to, and then you go into the attack phase. And you can attack with up to three cards. They don't have to be the same three that you moved.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And they pretty much have the melee cards have to be adjacent, and then range can attack up to two clear spaces away.
And that's any ranged guy, so it's not like you got the range three guys, the range five
right,
guys.
Yeah.
That's nice to have that consistency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are a few units to where each unit typically has one kind of special quirk, special ability. You know, like elven archers have far shot. They can shoot one farther space away. But, I mean, pretty much all of the stats will be there for you. It's pretty simple to get a hold of. To finish the turn is the build magic, where you can choose to discard any amount of cards from your hand and put them on your magic pile.
So how does the combat work? The game does come with a die, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have pretty much the biggest number on the card in the top left is your attack value. Most units will have a 1 or a 2. The more powerful ones will have 3 or 4. And that's how many dice you roll to attack. So say I'm attacking with a guy who has a combat, like an attack value of 2. I'd roll 2d6. Now, a hit is on a 3+. So it really favors the aggressor here. And then for each hit you get, you put a wound marker on the thing you targeted. It comes with these kind of little cardboard wound markers. Plenty. You shouldn't run out. And then if you kill it, it's removed from the board and put on your magic pile. Summoners especially will usually have an ability they can use in lieu of just a standard attack. But summoners usually can hit pretty hard, you know, 3 or 4 dice. And that is how a combat works.
Okay. So pretty much you're going to be taking turns, moving your stuff around, doing the combat, and mm-hmm. until one of the summoners gets killed, right?
Yep. Okay. It's that simple.
That is pretty simple.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts on Summoner Wars?
It's
having played it, like, you know, 6 or 7 times.
Yeah. Right? Pretty much everyone I've shown it to, and I had this exact same reaction when I started it, you're not real impressed by it, because you're just like, oh, it's just card-based combat. Oh, it's not very good. And then kind of like the halfway point, you start to kind of click, and then by the end of the game, you want to play again.
Yeah,
it's a real addicting game, and I like it because it gives you that kind of miniatures combat feel with a little CCG on it. You know, you got the cards and the fancy art and all that. It's just a really fun game, and you can tell it was designed by someone who played HeroScape, because it has that feel. And I mean that in kind of a really vague sense, you know. HeroScape was light, you know, rules light, but fun and just kind of just aggressive. And this is the same way.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to future expansions, future factions, kind of seeing what they bring. But I'm in. I really like it. It's something you can just kind of whip out, play in 20 minutes, and be done. And you still get kind of a rich tactical game out of it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. And I kind of like the way... It's got that War Machine sort of feel, because as far mm-hmm. as like model count goes, I mean models, cards, whatever,
yeah.
You know, you have about that same number, you know, as a small War Machine army, and it's got the same kind of objective of having to kill the summoner, but it's got sort of some board game constraints built in as far as movement, and you are on a grid, much like in HeroScape, you're on, you know, this hex sort of board. So I think it's really good for folks who enjoy board games and, you know, who would like sort of a miniatures game feel, but, you know, aren't going to even go play HeroScape and definitely wouldn't play War Machine. This is going to give you that same kind of a feel. Mm-hmm. And if you move into that, then it might move you on to some other things there too. There's another game that's out. That's a kind of a card based miniatures style game called Battleground Fantasy Warfare. And each of the cards in that game sort of represents a large unit of troops of, like, you know, 10 troops. And so that game sort of feels almost kind of Warhammer 40K, like, where you have all these, or Warhammer Fantasy Battles, you have a ton of people or things represented on these cards. Whereas Summoner Wars is basically like War Machine, where you just have one card equals one dude.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like that it's just a sort of a low model count. And like Cody says, it's really favors the aggressor with that 3+ hit. And, also, the fact that when your deck runs out, you're done. You know, you have mm-hmm. to basically scramble around with what you have to win the game. So.
And one of the nice things is, you know, I've played with all four factions, and even with this kind of fixed deck style of game, all of the factions play really differently. You know, like the cave goblins tend to do more kind of a swarm, very cheap and expendable units, but they just throw a ton at you. You know, you have the elves, which are pretty good at range. They have abilities that let them just pick off people at a distance. You know, all of them have a really unique flavor, and a lot of the preview cards I've seen for upcoming factions, it looks like they're going to be pretty unique too. And it's all very balanced. You know, I haven't seen one faction that really runs away with it. So it's a really fun game. I'd definitely give it a look.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. And you know, with that kind of a price point and with new stuff coming out, I think it's a good thing to check out. So that's our bonus review of Summoner Wars. Cody, thank you for the rules explanation.
No, thank you.
Well done, well done. And so now we promise we will move into our big deal where we're going to be talking about great versus fun. The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big.
The Great Debate. Number 34, TV4 or not TV4?
Hello. Should there be another television channel or should there not? On tonight's programme, the Minister for Broadcasting, the Right Honourable Mr. Ian Throat MP.
Good evening.
The Programme Controller for Amalgamated Money TV, Sir Abe Sappenheim.
Good evening.
The Shadow Spokesman for Television, Lord Kinwoody.
Hello.
And a television critic, Mr. Patrick Loon.
Hello.
Gentlemen, should there be a fourth television channel or not? Sir Abe.
Yes.
Ian.
No.
Patrick.
Yes.
Francis.
No.
Well, there you have it. Two say will, two say won't. We'll be back again next week, and next week's great debate will be about government interference in broadcasting, and will be cancelled mysteriously.
All right, well, it's time for our big deal, where we're going to talk about great versus fun, or fun versus great, however we've been marketing it.
That's right.
And a good way, how we kind of came up with this, we had suggestions, but when I look at the BGG, the Board Game Geek top 10, we'll say, I see a lot of games there that are great, but a lot of games there that I really don't think are a whole lot of fun. And yeah. Then conversely, there are games out there that I have just a hoot playing. But man, you tell some of the highbrow gamers that, oh yeah, you know, I played Monopoly Deal or something, and they'll look at you like you've got three eyes and like, how can you play that trash?
Oh my goodness, how could you?
So we're going to kind of break it down. We're going to give you some games that we think are great but not very fun, some games that are fun but not very great, and then top it all off, games that are great and fun.
I'm so confused.
Yeah, let's go to the flowchart.
Okay.
Column A.
Well, and I think that one of the reasons why, I think I had made some kind of passing comment about that, about games that are great but aren't necessarily fun, and we got a couple emails about it. And I think that what that ends up causing a lot of problems on sites like BoardGameGeek, because you end up with folks that really appreciate great games, and they equate that with fun. And so when some folks like us come along and say, yes, I appreciate that Puerto Rico is a well-designed, great game, but it's so boring and I hate playing it, I think you just get a lot of backlash of, well, how could you possibly not like that game? You know?
No.
But I think there is a distinction between great and fun. So let's talk a little bit about things that make a game great. And so I'll start off and just say that I think that really great components, really well-made components, are one of the things that might make a game great. It's a small element to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that that's trumped by some other things that we'll talk about in a second. But I think that a lot of Days of Wonder games fall into the great category. And one of the things that makes them that way is that their components are just fantastic. And I think that's a good thing. So
yeah. I think the thing that seems to be common in a lot of the great games that I've seen is just a real tightness of the game mechanics, where it might not necessarily be the most fun thing, but Puerto Rico, for example, has really tight mechanics. You know, it's there's not a lot of loopholes. Everything is well thought through, and you know, it's you can tell there's a lot of testing done to it. Everything is well balanced. It's just tight is the best word. It's just this very refined kind of mechanic to it.
Anytime that you sit down to a game and the rules are explained to you, and then you have like maybe four or five questions of, what about this? What about this? And each one of those questions can be answered exactly with a game mechanic that's been designed for that particular exception. That's a great set of rules then, mm-hmm. You know. And, you know, there's lots of games, I think, that have come out in the last few years especially that I think have that. I think the word we end up using for that is elegance.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
And when I think of elegance, I think of like a crystal chandelier. I don't really think about like, you know, a game, but
yeah.
But that's a word that's used an awful lot about, you know, how there's good balance in the game. Yeah. I think that's another important element in a game is balance, where you don't feel like things are weighed too heavy in one direction or with one particular play style. And that if someone gets really far ahead in a game, that you know, if there's a catch-up mechanic and that, that balancing mechanic as far as that goes, then I think a lot of that's a really great aspect to a game.
Yeah, and I'll even throw in just a little RPG into this element. Fourth edition Dungeons & Dragons is actually a really good example of this. Everything, this was a game that was built fresh from the ground up with balance in mind, with kind of tightness of mechanics in mind, and it succeeds in that. Everything that has been put out is very well balanced with older and newer materials, and it's well thought out and it's streamlined, but even then it's almost so balanced that, you know, the combats take a while just because, you know, no one has a clear advantage over the other or things like that. So to me, that's an example where you could say, you know, fourth edition D&D, great game, but it's almost so balanced and so refined that it becomes a slog.
Right. A recent game that comes to mind for me in the great category is Dominion, which of course is currently number one on my top 11. But and a lot of that just has to do with the fact that it is a simple yet tight rule set that is very, you know, very well balanced, and it's innovative. You know, I think that's another aspect of a great game is, you know, a game that can bring something new to the equation. A lot of people would consider Settlers of Catan to be a great game. Mm-hmm. A lot of it being because that's the first time that a lot of those mechanics, you know, the kind of collection of resources and things like that those really appeared on the scene. Now, for those of you who are board game aficionados from years and years ago, I know that some of the mechanics in Settlers existed in other games prior to that, but I'm, you know, talking about how this one brought it into the mainstream,
right,
which put it into that great category. I think that integration of theme is actually a quality that will make a game great. So I think a game like Fury of Dracula, I think it's a really good integration of theme. I think a lot of the Fantasy Flight games that have come out in the last few years have done an excellent job of weaving theme into the gameplay.
Yeah. I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, not with the Fantasy Flight, but with the theme being what considers a great game. Because I almost think more mechanically based, like as far as the BGG definition of a great game.
Oh, I'm talking about my definition of a great game.
Oh, okay, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. A BGG definition of a game.
Yeah.
And again, we're making big generalizations about Board Game Geek, you know, but based upon their top 10, especially, it is very much mechanically based.
Right? Sorry about that.
No, you're fine. but for me, when I'm making my list of if we were to make our top 11 great games, you know, that would be an important part for me. And I think that's where the intersection of fun and greatness might start to come into play a little bit.
Yeah, because with me, my top 11 great games would be my top 11 list, because fun is just so much a part of how I would rate that game, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard for me. I can step back and say, you know, like last episode, Agricola, that is a really well-designed, that is a great game as far as design, but it is as boring as watching paint dry, you know, and so it'll never make my list, even though it mechanically is a very well-built game and one that'll probably stand the test of time, and it's really popular because of that. It just doesn't strike that fun chord with me.
Yeah, well, it doesn't strike the fun chord with you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of a strange discussion here because are these things mutually exclusive? You know, can you really have something you could consider a great game that is just not any fun? I mean, I know you said about Agricola, but you still said you wouldn't put that on your top 10.
Right.
Top 11. We don't do top 10s here. Top 11 great games, you know.
I think it's more of a appreciation of it.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's like, I can appreciate that is a well-put-together game. I hate playing it. But, you know, I can stand from afar and say, oh, yeah, you know, I think that's very good. Like, you know, some people with opera, you know, they can appreciate that a lot of work goes into that and a lot of, you know, it's just technically very good, but man, they can't listen to it, you know.
Right.
That's how I kind of equate it.
Okay. So, you know, again, going back to like my definition of a great game, you know, that theme integration I think is important. And like I said, I think Fantasy Flight has done a real good job with that. I think that Rune Wars I would put into a great game category because of that, because I feel like the mechanics and the theme are really well woven in. But at the same time, that's also, for me, a very fun game.
Yeah.
And so that also goes in that category. So what kind of things for you, you know, we've kind of talked about greatness, you know, and what our kind of cobbled together definition is of that. You know, really tight mechanics, innovation, what was the first thing that we said? Balance, things like that. You know, these are things that almost from a mathematical perspective,
right.
Make it, you know, really well done. Reiner Knizia is always considered to be a great game designer. And, you know, Reiner Knizia's training, I believe, is in, I think he has a PhD in mathematics or physics or something like that. And so his games all tend to be variations on different mathematical themes that are then have, you know, the Reiner Knizia theme all painted over top of it with whatever theme it happens to be. But, you know, the greatness in those games is linked to the mechanics and linked to the mathematics and the and how that's all worked out, how those equations work. What is it that makes a game fun? And that, I think, is a very personalized question. But for Cody, what makes a game fun for you?
To me, it's how often you really want to get it to the table. You know, to me, there's a big difference in saying, hey, I've got game X you want to play. Oh, yeah, sure, that's fine. Versus, hey, I really want to play game X. You know, let's bring out Dominion. Let's bring out Last Night on Earth. You know, whatever. It's that enthusiasm and getting everyone else that's playing enthusiastic about it, too. I think a lot of it is that social element that a game is really fun where even if it's kind of a quiet and contemplative sort of a game, you can tell everyone's having fun. You're talking about it afterwards. It kind of transcends just being a game and it becomes part of that social element, you know, where it just kind of flips that switch and you're like, man, I'm having just a ton of fun with this.
Right. And, you know, it's funny if you go around the boardroom at Origins, you see such a wide variety of board games, a lot of Euro games, but also a lot of other games. You know, we played games of Box of Golf and Last Night on Earth and things like that. It was the big Wits and Wagers game. And there's folks sitting around having fun doing those. And then you go to other sections where there's folks playing, you know, really deep Euro games like Agricola and that kind of stuff, you know, and they're having fun too. But they're sitting and they're staring, you know? Yeah. And so to me, it makes greatness seem a little bit more static, you know? Like you could almost quantify, here's what makes something great, maybe. But as far as fun goes, it seems like that's a lot more of a dynamic thing. And it's really very much dependent on individuals, you know? And maybe getting individuals together that have the same definition of fun.
Yeah. You know? Well, it's kind of the old joke, you know? You have the you can tell if the Euro gamers are having fun because no one's saying anything and they're all just staring at the board.
Right, such a good time.
And then the Ameritrashers are hooting, hollering, and they're, yeah, rolling dice, and you know, having a good old time. You know, you brought up Box of Golf, you know. That's not a great game by any. That's probably not even a good game. Yeah. You know, that's just kind of a novelty game. But we have a blast every year playing it. And it's just this stupid, very random game. Like, random even past the Ameritrash allowance point for me. But it's still just, it's the first thing we play at Origins, and we have a blast doing it. And I can't explain why.
I think that fun tends to also be dependent on who you're playing with over and above, you know, what exactly you're playing. A good example is my daughter is 4. She just turned 4 this past week. And so I bought her, because I know she loves princesses and things like that, I bought her the game Pretty Pretty Princess. And it's like Sleeping Beauty, Pretty Pretty Princess. The whole point of this game, it's really a terrible it's a terrible game. It's just a little roll and move game.
It's on my top 11, so I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not sure which top 11, but you know, it's like a roll and move game where you're trying to collect jewelry out of this little plastic, you know, trinket jewelry, and get a full set of earrings and a necklace and a bracelet. I basically bought it because I thought that my daughter would think it was funny to dress up daddy in, you know, princess outfits and stuff. So and I'll take one for the team because it makes my little girl smile. So you know, but that game, sitting with her and watching her just laugh at me while I put my little earrings on and everything, is so much fun, you know. But it has more to do with this little girl that I love sitting next to me than it has to do with the game at all, you know. And so, and I think that that's, you know, that could even get into a long discussion about game groups, you know, is if you have the right group of people, it doesn't really matter what you pull out, you know. No.
There's gonna be some fun if you pull out Carcassonne,
it's not gonna be
no
fun.
One goes home happy.
Everyone suffers.
Oh, jeez.
So, I mean, for me, I think a fun aspect is, I think we've talked about this before, theme is important. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that feeling like you're doing something more than just pushing cubes and bits around on a board.
You hear that, Euro games? I'm sorry, though.
But a lot of that, I think, is just how well you can convert in your head those little bits on the board to an actual themey sort of a thing, you know. I love the game Power Grid, you know. It takes a little bit to get your brain into the mode of I'm building a series of generators and stuff, you know. But, you know, it's the fun is still there, you know, kind of built into the mechanics and the social interaction, all that kind of stuff.
You know, it's sounding a lot in our definitions of fun. It's like once the experience of playing the game has transcended the game itself, that's when it really crosses that line, and that's when it really becomes, air quote, fun.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't really know what that means, but it's kind of like,
it's very deep.
Yeah, no, hey, man. You know, it's just like when it becomes, you know, not an event like we've talked about with event games, but it's like, you know, growing up, you know, we played Talisman. Not a great game.
Not a great game.
You know, but some of those experiences are the ones that stick with me the most because we were all so into it. And, you know, it's kind of a crappy game, but we were all having a lot of fun with it. And that's why I still have a copy of Talisman on my shelf when every other part of me says I really shouldn't have that game because it's not that good.
Yeah, but you just keep it because of that kind of nostalgia because of the fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think of a game like Diplomacy, which I would put that in the great game category as far as the way those very simple mechanics are designed.
Elegant.
Elegant mechanics. And the way that, you know, the negotiation phases are designed. It's so simple, and yet there's just such longevity to it. The game's been around for more than 50 years.
And with no, I mean, as far as to my knowledge, they haven't really changed much of anything about it.
No.
You know,
no.
It's not like there's a bunch of errata for it.
No.
Or there's updates. You know, it's Diplomacy. It's in a new shiny box. It's Diplomacy.
Different little cardboard pieces.
Yep.
But that game, I think, is a lot of fun. The reason why I think it's fun is because of the experience that I had with it, you know, with those particular people that we played with during the Day of Diplomacy last year, and had a great time with that. But if you talk to a lot of other folks, there's folks who won't ever play Diplomacy because they had a bad experience with it. So, you know, maybe the greatness of that game isn't in question, you know, but the fun is going to be very dependent on the people that you're playing with.
Yep.
So you're right. I think it's when you... When
the game transcends just the act of playing the game, when it becomes, you know, just kind of this social event or this, without getting too deep about, you know, this kind of moment where
it creates memories.
Yeah,
right?
There you go. When it becomes like that memorable moment and you really can't wait to play it again.
Yeah.
That's a fun game for me.
Yeah, I think that's probably for me too. Now, I think that, you know, our listeners, you guys probably have different definitions of what fun is.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to hear from you listeners, and you know, feel free to write the game on inbox
or call
the game on voicemail box, and let us know. You know, what's your definition of greatness, and you know, what's your definition of fun? Because, and are those the same thing? Mm-hmm. You know, can you separate those things out? I mean, it's all just, this is sort of a trite conversation, except that I think it really does speak to what games end up in your collection, which things you end up throwing away, and which things get to the table and which things don't. You know, are the great things going to get to the table that aren't fun?
No.
You know, or are the fun things going to get to the table that maybe aren't great?
No.
Or
I'm thinking it's the fun gets to the table.
Yeah.
Because the great games almost become like a museum piece.
Yeah.
Know? It's like, oh, I've got Agricola. Yeah, we never bring it out, but you know,
it's a great game.
It's a great game. Yeah. And I should have it in my collection, so it just sits there gathering dust.
Yeah.
You know, whereas we may play Last Night on Earth, you know, still a good game, but it's by no means, you know, this elegantly designed game with tight mechanics, you know.
Right.
It's a fun zombie shooting game. Yeah.
So what are if you can think of off the top of your head some examples of well, we've talked about great games that aren't fun, so and we all have kind of a different list. You don't like Power Grid, right?
No.
Would you recognize that that's probably a great game?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So a lot of the stuff that's in the top 10 in Board Game Geek, which are things like Puerto Rico, Agricola, Twilight Struggle, which I think is a great game and a fun game, but things like Dominion is one that's I would consider a great game and a fun game, but you know, those things, I think most folks would agree about the greatness of those games. Maybe not, and if you disagree, write in or call in. Want to hear about it? but what about games that you think are fun, but they're just not great? Besides Talisman, I know you mentioned Talisman.
Yeah, and I'll probably get a lot of flack on this. Monopoly is always kind of like the redheaded stepchild, you know, everyone's like, well, you know, on Board Game Geek, like, well, it's better than Monopoly at least. I don't think Monopoly is that bad of a game.
Right.
You know, it's one of those where it's not a great game, but I have fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Trivial Pursuit's another one. A lot of people will just say, oh, that is not a well-designed game. But I have a lot of fun with it because I like trivia. I like games like that, like Tribond, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they aren't great games, but they're a heck of a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, I think that's you know what? Now that I think about it, if you go into the mass market, you know, mm-hmm. there really are a lot of games there that I think fall into the fun but not great category. Yeah. And I think that's why they get sold so much, is because people do want to sit down and play Pretty Pretty Princess, mm-hmm. you know, and those kinds of games, because they do have an element of fun to them, but no one's going to say that Pretty Pretty Princess is, you know, yeah. Board Game Geek Top 10.
Now the king of the fun but not great is Lupin Louie.
Oh.
I mean, this is like, you know, this is, I want to import this game from Germany, which $30-$40 for a stupid kids game, but I can't stop playing it. It's so fun, but it's not a great game. It's a little battery-operated guy trying to knock things off your barn. You know?
Yeah, but it's fun. I mean, yeah, yep. Play it over and over again. Mm-hmm. I would say Flux is in that category.
Ah, there you go.
I don't think that Flux, you know, sorry, Mr. Looney, but I don't personally think that Flux is a great game, but I think it's just a ton of fun.
I would say all of the Looney games almost fall into that category.
Right.
They're not these elegant games, but they are a heck of a lot of fun. That's why I want to go into this tiki room and play Looney Labs games a couple hours a day.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of fun.
So, I mean, it would be kind of fun, I think, to put together like a list of what we can, you know, maybe an objective list, if we can even do that, mm-hmm. of what would be a great game. Because I think what's in a fun game is just really going to depend on the person.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, like Trivial Pursuit is one that I think is I love trivia as well. It's a lot of fun, but it's not necessarily great. I like playing Uno. You know, mm-hmm. I think playing Uno is fun.
Yeah.
Uno's not a great game, but it's a ton of fun. So, anyway, so you know, listeners, we'd love to hear what you think about this. We just kind of got to thinking about this topic of great versus fun, and you know, I'm not sure if we drew any conclusions, but but hey, it was fun to sit and talk about it for a while.
It was a good discussion,
and so we'd love to hear your comments about this, and we'd love to talk about them next time. So if you want to talk to us about what your definition of great or fun is, write us at the Game On Inbox
at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Or you can call into the Game On voicemail box at 4138-GAME-ON.
I knew it, too. I was ready to jump in.
I can see you over there, yeah. That's 413-842-6366. And let us know what you think about this topic. And I think that's a close to our big deal.
Yeah.
All right.
Again, sounds fun.
Good discussion. Sounds great.
Ah. But seriously, here's Buy, Try, or Die.
Okay.
Buy, Try, or Deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple.
All aboard!
All right, it's time for Buy, Try, or Deny, and we have one I'm really excited for from Days of Wonder, Mystery Express, a whodunit on rails, or the box might say.
You might.
But John's going to give you the rules rundown you've come to expect, and one that I couldn't do, so here you go, John.
Okay, so thank you, Cody.
Thank you.
Mystery Express was designed by Antoine Bauza and Serge Lager. Produced by Days of Wonder Games, and is for 3 to 5 players, ages 12 and up. Plays in about 60 to 90 minutes. I think it's probably closer to 90 minutes.
Yeah, I don't see it in 60 unless everyone really knows the rules and there's not a lot of talking.
And going real fast and not a lot of talking, yeah. So we play kind of a leisurely game. But here's the fluff from the first page of the rule book. Seeking a well-deserved break from your latest misadventures, you decide to treat yourself to the extravagant luxury of the legendary Orient Express. Thank you.
Thank you.
But your holiday turns out to be short-lived.
Da-na-na.
The train has barely left Paris when tragedy strikes.
Oh, no.
A passenger is found murdered. The aptly renamed Mystery Express hurtles towards its final destination.
Keep reading.
Okay. Locked on board anxious passengers spin a web. Are you okay?
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't do the trick.
Locked on board, anxious passengers spin a web of intrigue and deception. Your mind races as you consider all possible suspects and their motives. Will you uncover the culprit before reaching the end of your journey? Very nice.
That's all I got for you.
So, as you can see, sort of the point of this game is to determine different parameters about a murder. This sounds probably to you a lot like another game that you played in your childhood, Clue.
Yes.
And you would be right. There are some similarities there in that there's a mystery to be solved, and there's some elements of this mystery that you're going to try to figure out. But I think you'll find as we go over the rules here that it's a lot different from Clue in the way that you find out that information. There's also a whole lot more information to find out. So as always, the object of the game is to win. And the way that you win in this game is at the end of the journey of the Orient Express, the Mystery Express here, you're going to, based upon your investigations, you're going to give your guesses as to five different aspects of a particular murder. And those aspects are, who did it, the suspect, the motive, the modus operandi, or, kind of how it was done.
The M.O.
the M.O. things like hanged, pushed, poisoned, things like that, shot. And then you also have the location, which is which train car on the Orient Express the murder took place. And then the last one, which is by far the hardest one to figure out, the time that it happened. So five things there. So instead of just being three, I think was it three things in Clue?
Yeah, it's three.
Okay.
It's location, weapon, and who.
And who did it. Okay. Yeah. So here there's going to be five things you're going to find out, but it's going to be real kind of a clever way to figure it all out. So the game comes with, at the end of the game, you're going to reveal what your guesses are, and then you'll reveal the cards that have been, that have all of that information on them. Whoever has the most correct that match will be the winner. If there's a tie, then there's a very interesting way to break ties that I'll talk about in a second. So that's the basics there. So, well, let me just talk to you about the setup of the game. The game comes with a very nice board. It's kind of an elongated board. It's not a square board. And it's in the shape of a train where you have your different train cars. And that's in the top part of the board. And in each of these train cars, you're going to be able to do different actions. And so we'll go over those in turn here. But so you have six different train cars that you can go to. Underneath that, on the board, there's an area that shows where the train is on its journey. So during the course of the game, the train is going to travel from Paris to Istanbul.
And not Constantinople.
Not Constantinople, no. And you're going to travel through four cities on your way there. So you're going to travel through Strasbourg, Munich, or Munchen? I don't speak German.
Munich?
Sorry. Wien and Budapest. Maybe Wien is Vienna?
Yeah, it's Vienna.
Okay, very good. American on. and so you're going to go through those cities. During your journey, each journey between those two cities is going to take a certain number of hours. And it's those hours that are sort of your currency for the actions that you can take while you're on your journey. And so it's almost like a certain number of action points that you're going to get. When you reach each individual station, different things will happen in each station. Then the train will leave again, and you'll have a certain number of hours to accomplish more sleuthing and discovering information. So that's that part of the board. And then underneath that, or right to the next to that, there's two stacks for these passenger decks that we'll talk about in a second. You'll have passengers that are going to come onto the train at certain times, and you'll be able to get information from them. And then there's also a space for three cards that are considered the conductor's cards, because one of the things you can do is talk to the conductor and get information from him. So that's your board. And then you're going to have your own little playing area there. Each player is going to get a ticket wallet, which is kind of a folding cardboard piece here that is going to hold your, score sheet or your deduction sheet, your investigation sheet, I guess. And this is going to be a piece of paper that's out of a rather thick pad of paper. They gave you a ton of these in the box. Probably more than 100, I would say. Mm-hmm. So you have lots of replayability as far as that goes. And this is going to give you all of the different options and allow you to sort of cross things out as you deduce that, certain things can be ruled out. So you're going to keep that tucked into your ticket wallet so the other players can't see it. This is real nice. It makes a real sort of a clean design for you to be able to keep things secret. You're also going to get a little player token, and that's going to mark your discard pile. And then, and it's also going to mark when you've used your special ability. There, like I said, it's for three to five players, and so there's five different colored players, and then each player will have a certain special ability. When you set up the game, you're going to have separate decks of cards for colored decks of cards for the modus operandi, the motive, the suspect, and the location. So you're going to start off by shuffling those up separately and then taking one card out of each one. So this is going to be the things that you're going to be trying to find out during the course of the game. These are the different elements of the murder. And then you also have a time deck, which is a separate deck that's sort of a different shape, and it's going to be separate. You're going to pull one of the cards out of that to determine that'll indicate what time the murder happened. So then you're going to shuffle that time deck up and put that to the side of the board. The rest of the cards that you have, all these other four colored decks, you're going to shuffle them all together into one big deck, shuffle that all up, and then you're going to hand out seven cards to each player. Now, depending on how many players you play with, you might remove certain cards from the game, certain suspects and certain MOs and things like that. So that's sort of balanced based upon the number of players that you have. So all of the cards that are the elements of the actual murder are going to just slide right under the board, and so you'll keep those secret until the end of the game. The idea here is that each of these different elements, so like a suspect, like, what is a good name for a suspect? Like Candy, the flapper girl, you know? There's going to be two cards with her picture on it, two Candy cards. And so one of those cards is going to go into this pile of elements cards that you'll look at the end of the game. That means that only one Candy card is available for viewing. And so that's what you're trying to do sort of in the course of this whole game, is you're trying to find these pairs of cards. So if you were to see two cards with Candy's picture on them, then you can rule out that she is not the murderer. But the interesting thing is that you have to see both of those cards on the same turn, because these cards are going to be passed around among the different players depending on these actions that are taken. And so if you see her card on one turn and then you see it on the other turn, on another turn, it may not be a pair of cards. It might be you've just seen the same card twice on two different turns. So you have to sort of keep all that straight. So everybody's going to look at their cards, and if you happen to be lucky enough to already have a pair of cards in your hand, then you can go ahead and cross that off of your investigation sheet to show that that's definitely not one of the elements there. So then you're going to take some of the cards and put three cards and put them on the conductor's area, and then you're going to put the rest of the cards in two equal piles in the passenger's area. You're going to get your own little pawn that represents your player, and you can put your character anywhere on the train to start off with. You're also going to put these little tokens for the conductor on the different destinations that are available to you during the course of your trip. And this is going to indicate where the conductor is during each journey. And that'll allow you to go and talk to the conductor and get information from him. So that's the basic setup of the game. The only other last thing that you're going to get is each person will get a telegram sheet. And this is a small little pad of paper that you get that looked like an old school telegram, like from the turn of the century. And what you're going to do in that is that when you get to the Budapest location, which is the second to last, at that location, you're going to sort of make your guesses at that point to see which all the different elements of the murder. And you're going to write all those down, as many as you can, and then you're going to fold that up and put it underneath the table. The board.
Under the table?
Not under the table, under the board. So that at the end of the game, if there happens to be a tie, you're going to look at those pieces of paper, and whoever had the most correct at that point in the game, that's going to determine your tie-breaking thing there. So interesting idea for a tiebreaker. So here's just sort of how the basics of the game work. You're going to have this pile of cards in your hand. On your turn, you're going to have a certain number of hours in which to do things on the train. And the different locations on the train have actions that take a certain number of hours to do. So there's the club car, the dining car, the lounge car, the passenger car, the sleeping car, and the smoking car. And you can move around. It doesn't cost anything to move. And on each of these different locations, you're going to get to do certain things. So, and they cost a certain number of hours. So in each of these cars and each of these actions, you're going to get to do either one of a couple of things. You're either going to get to look at another player's cards or card, or one or more cards, or you're going to actually acquire those cards. So some of the cards will have like a little symbol with an eyeball on it showing that you're going to be able to look at cards, but then the other player will get to keep them. And then other ones, it'll have like a little hand with cards showing that you're going to be getting those cards. So, for example, if you're in the lounge car, where it's the fluff text and the rule says, a snifter of brandy or a glass of fine claret may loosen a few tongues.
Ooh.
So that action takes 2 hours to perform. And it says that every player except for you must simultaneously reveal one of the crime category cards of your choice. So you're going to pick a category like motive. And every other player is going to pick a motive card out of their hand, and they're going to have to reveal it to everybody at the table. And so 1, 2, 3, and everybody turns them over. And so now based on this, you're going to write down in your investigation sheet what you've observed. So maybe if you played like a 4-player game, 3 cards would be revealed. Well, if 2 of those cards happen to be the same card, well, then you've now made a decision about one particular element. One particular motive is definitely not it, and you can rule it out. So throughout the course of this whole thing, you're going to be gathering these information on these cards and kind of jotting them down in your investigation sheet to rule things out. And they sort of explain in the rules some specific ways you can do that with little slashes and X's and things like that. So that would be the lounge car. But all of the players who revealed those cards, they still get to keep them. Now, whether a card is viewed or whether it's acquired, it's still discarded. So once it comes out of your hand, either to be viewed by another player or given to another player, it's then going to go into a discard pile. And then you're going to mark that discard pile with your little player token. You're going to put that on top. So over the course of these different actions that people are taking, you know, cards are going to be going out of your hand and into your discard pile. You know, so eventually you'll have possibly no cards in your hand at some point. So the action that's in the club car, which takes an hour to do, will allow you to force one other player, or yourself if you want, to immediately take back into your hand all of the cards from one crime category. So if you're really, really looking for motive cards on this particular journey, then you might see that one particular player, based upon other actions that have been taken, has like 5 or 6 motive cards in their discard pile, and some of them you haven't seen yet. Well, then you can force them to pull those cards back up into their hand, and then maybe you could go and perform another action that would force that player to reveal one of those cards to you. So this is how you're trying to search for that information. So that's the club car. The dining car is one where you can take a certain number of hours equal to the number of players that you invite to dinner. So if you invited 2 players, that would be 2 hours to take for this action. And you don't actually have to move their pawns into there. You would just say, I'm inviting you 2 guys to dinner. And so then what you would do is you would choose one category for each of the players. Like, you know, Cody, I'm choosing motive for you. And then, you know, another player, I would choose modus operandi or something like that. And then they would have to reveal to you the cards of that type. It has to be different categories. And once you've looked at them, then they can put them back on their own discard pile. So that's allow you to get a little piece of information from, you know, several different people. So that's the dining car. The smoking car is one where it takes 3 hours, the action that you do there. And what you're going to do is you would ask any other 2 other players to give you a crime element card of your choice. And those can be from the same category. Actually, it has to be from the same category. So I could ask 2 players to give me a suspect card. And so they would have to give me those 2 cards. Those cards would become mine, and they would go in my discard pile. And then I would take 2 cards out of my hand, and I would give 1 to each of those players. So this is sort of a way to trade information. But you have the possibility of getting 2 pieces of information of the same category. You know, you have the chance there of possibly getting a pair of cards and being able to rule something out. That's kind of what you're going for here. So that's the smoking car. You have the passenger car. And the passenger car is kind of like the round robin car. This takes 1 hour to do. And what you're going to do is you're going to name a category. And then you're going to designate a player seated immediately to your left or your right. And then you're going to have them pass a card to you from that category. And so then you would look at that card, and then you would discard that card. And then from your hand, you're going to pick a card from the same category and pass it to the player to your right. and that's going to continue and go all around, all the way around the table until you get to the person who started. If you don't have a card of that category, then you basically will just look at the card that you get and then pass that card on to the next player. So this is a way for kind of everybody to get a little bit of information about a different card. Again, these cards are actually trading hands. So that's your passenger car. So then you also have the sleeping car, and this one's a lot of fun because it's got a nice little component element to it. In this game, you're going to, or in this action, you're going to take a bit of a risk, because what you're going to be basically trying to do is look through all of your, look through an opponent's luggage. And so the game comes with this little, I guess it's like a, is it, what is it, plastic or resin or some metal?
I almost think it's wood. It might be plastic.
Might be wood. I don't know, but it's yeah. It's like a little carpet bag kind of a thing. And what you're going to do is you're going to hand that to a player that you want to possibly take a card from. And they're going to hide those behind their back and put that little bag into one of their hands. Kind of like a game of, what do you call that game? guess which hand it's in.
Yeah, I don't know.
That classic game of guess which hand. And then the you're going to guess which hand that bag is in, and if you're right, then you are going to be able to take a card by basically rummaging through the affairs, and you're going to be able to gain a card of the category of your choice, picked at random from the ones that are in that player's hands. So you'll be able to claim a card. If you do that, then that's going to take 2 hours. If you choose the wrong hand and it doesn't have the bag in it, then you will have basically wasted your turn and you've lost an hour, and then you won't be able to do that action again. So these are all the things that you have available to you. And it seems like a lot of stuff, but once you kind of get into the flow of how these actions work, it's very, very simple. Mm-hmm. There's icons on the board that make it real easy too. So you have a certain number of hours between each city, and you're going to take turns going around the table, and each player will use up those hours performing actions in each of these locations. So the other thing that I mentioned was that there's the conductor, and the conductor is going to be in a particular location based upon that little token that's on the board for each journey. And what you will be able to do is if you go into the room, the car where the conductor is, and you perform the action that's in that room, then you can also perform the conductor's action for free. Now, like I said, on the board, there are three cards that are like the conductor's cards, and they're face down on the board. So you can see the backs of these cards. I don't know if I explained this quite well, but the backs of these cards are different colors. So you can see just by looking at someone's hand or looking on the board what kind of card it is. You just don't know the specifics of that card, but you'll know whether it's an MO card or a motive card or a location card. So there's going to be three cards on that conductor's area. If you go into a room and perform the action there where the conductor is, then you can perform the conductor's action, which is you can look at one of the cards that's one of those three cards, and you're going to claim that card and put it in your discard pile, and then you're going to replace it with one from your hand. So that's another way for you to get some information that maybe no one else would be able to get. So that's another kind of interesting thing that you can do as far as the conductor goes. As you continue on, you're going to move to your location, and each of the different locations has sort of some different local events that happen. So in the cities of Strasbourg and Vienna, there are passengers that are going to get onto the train, and they're going to go and hang out in the club car. So after the Strasbourg location, which is the second location, then there's going to be a passenger in the club car. So if you go to the club car then, you have an additional action available to you, and that's going to allow you to look and take a card from one of these passenger decks that's on the board. So there's two of those passenger decks. After the first passenger gets on, you can look at one of those decks and grab one card out of there. It takes 3 hours to do that action in the club car. After you get through Vienna, the second passenger will be on board, and you can look through either one of those decks. When I say look through, you can look at what kind of cards they are and select one. You can't actually, riff through it and look at all of them. And you can grab one of those cards. Again, you're getting information that nobody else is getting, because that's the only place where you can get those cards. And, you're getting them and putting them into your own pile. So then for someone else to get that information, they would have to try to, get that particular information from you at a later time. So those can be really valuable. When you go into Munich, then that's going to be going into the long tunnel. So before you get to the Munich location, everybody's going to put their cards kind of face down, and you're going to be able to peek at a card from the player on your left and the player on your right. So you're going to put your cards down, you're going to just kind of take a peek at particular cards, and that's like you going in the tunnel and kind of, you know, peeking at stuff. So that's that. And then when you get to Budapest, that's going to be where you're going to write out that telegram, you know, where you're writing down your suspicions on the telegram, and you know, and as the tiebreaker for the game. Also in Budapest, I think they call it like a startling revelation or something like that. Everybody that's in the game is going to take one of their cards and reveal it to everybody, and it's going to sit face up on the board, and that's open information for everybody until the end of the game. So things are just going to continue, and you're going to go through all these locations, performing all these actions, trying to get as much information as possible to be able to rule out things on the board. Now, there's one element that I didn't mention, and that's the time element. So all of these cards that we're trading back and forth are for the four kind of colored categories, modus operandi, suspect, location, and motive. The time that the murder happened is a little bit different. This deck of cards has three of each of the particular times. And I think there's like six or seven. I want to say it's like six or seven times on the sheet. It's not like, you know, every time.
Yeah, it's six or seven.
Okay. And so, you know, there are three of each of those times in the cards and in the deck. So you're trying to figure out, you know, which one has been removed. And so you're going to be doing this by performing these time actions at particular points during the game. And those happen in the cities of Strasbourg, Vienna, and Budapest. And this is basically just a way for all of these cards that are in this deck to be revealed to you, so you can sort of try to pick out which one is missing. It's really challenging. It's a really challenging part of the game. But the very first time that you do this, the first time that the cards are going to be dealt out is in Strasbourg. Basically, the active player is going to take and is going to slowly flip over each individual card, one on top of the other, as fast or as slow as they want. And so you're going to get to witness these cards just rolling through the deck, and you'll get to see them. When you get to Vienna, all of the cards are going to be dealt out, you know, in equal portion, and then and face down. And then someone's going to say go, and you're going to look at all the cards that are in your hand. And then when that player says pass, you're going to pass them to your left, and then you're going to look at the next set. And then when they say pass, you're going to look at the next set, and until all the cards have been looked at. So, you know, you may not get too many seconds to do this. And actually, when we played, Cody said pass after like 1.5 seconds. So
yeah, because my strategy with time, and it actually worked out, was to, instead of finding the one correct time, I basically tried to narrow it down to two, maybe three, and then just take my guess. Because yeah, it's just so, at least I think it's so hard to nail it down. I had enough time, because I was the one who was saying pass. I could basically look and narrow it down, and, you know, I had a time in mind. I'm like, okay, I'm looking for 4:45. Are any of these this? No, pass. Mm-hmm. Any of these this? No, pass. And I knew, I mean, maybe it was a jerk move, I don't know, but
it was.
It's a strategy. And I didn't want to, you know, I was figuring the other players were trying to nail down a specific time, and I didn't want to give them any extra time to do that. So I just looked real quick to see if anything matched my kind of knocking it out, and then passed.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were all kind of ticked at me. But
well, and one thing I didn't mention is the fact that all of these times are, you know, not digital times. It's all clock hands, and they don't even have the numbers on the clock. So it's just the position of these, the short hand and the long hand there. So really a challenging part of it. So, you know, like I said, Strasbourg, you're just flipping the deck over real quick. And then in Vienna, you're going to be dealing out those cards and passing them around. And then in Budapest, the active player is going to take the deck of cards and start dealing them out in groups of three face up. So 1, 2, 3, and then 1, 2, 3 to cover up the ones that are already there. And it's going to do that just real methodically. And you're not allowed to write down anything while the cards are being dealt out.
Right.
Because the person who's dealing the cards then would be at a disadvantage. So you have to wait until all of them are dealt out, and then you can make your notes if you need to. I just found this was really challenging. I had a real hard time with it. But it is, you know, it is a way to do it. So that's that mechanic for the time. So that is the basics of Mystery Express. I know it seems like there's a whole lot there that I went over, and there are a lot of actions. But once you sort of get into the flow of the game, it's actually pretty easy to do. And when you get to the end of the journey there, then you're basically just going to reveal what your guesses are for everything, and you'll see how many of them match up with the stuff that was on under the board. And then if there's a tie, then you'll go to those tiebreaker things. And the way that the telegram thing works is that for everything that you've written down on the telegram that's correct, you get like a +1 point. For everything you've written down in the telegram that's incorrect, you get a -1 point. So when you write out that tie-breaking telegram, you want to be real careful. You know, you can only put if you want to put just a couple of pieces of information on there that you're sure about, that might be the best way to go, because you don't want to get negative points. But that is Mystery Express in a nutshell there, in a very, very large nutshell. So, Cody, we'll go ahead and start, like we've said before, the way we do our reviews now is we do buy points, try points, and deny points.
Mm-hmm.
Good, okay, and bad things about this particular game. So yep. Why don't you give me your buy points for Mystery Express, and I'm going to get a drink of water.
Okay. You can definitely tell it's a Days of Wonder game. I mean, if you've played any of their other ones, the production value is top-notch, and Mystery Express is no different. I mean, I really like the theme of it, kind of like the Mystery Train, you know, the old, almost, you know, the 1920s sort of a feel of it. 1920s?
Probably earlier than that.
Okay. But
I don't know the exact year.
Yeah, thereabouts. But anyway, the production quality, the components, everything is just so well done. The theme is just so kind of just liberally put on there, and you can't help but kind of feel like you're in exploring a mystery on a train. I even thought that this would be a cool one to even dim the lights a little bit and kind of, you know, just really get into the theme of it, because the game makes it so easy. It's nice to have kind of a clue alternative out there. I know Days of Wonder put out another game called Mystery of the Abbey. I've not played it. I've heard it is somewhat similar to this, so I can't make any comparisons there. I actually kind of like Clue, the base game. It's okay. You can get kind of stuck in the hallways, you know, uh-huh, because of the movement aspect. But deduction game, the idea of it, I like. And this was kind of a nice addition to the gamer game arsenal there. So you have something besides Clue to throw out there. It's just well done, looks great, and it's a Days of Wonder game, so everything has a purpose graphically, I think. You know, you have like the little icons out there that you may not even notice the first time you play, but that later in the game, once you've played it a few more times, it can really be an aid to help speed up play and things like that.
I think my buy points are really similar, because, you know, the production values are fantastic. I don't think I mentioned that your little pawn for your character is like a little plastic bust. Mm-hmm. I mean, of the character. You know, and each of the characters has a special ability to it. I didn't really even go into that, but you know, it just allows you to do some extra things there. The board is beautiful. The artwork is beautiful. I like Clue too. I think it's a pretty decent game, but I just thought that this was a much better integration of theme and mechanics together. And, you know, things like the conductor and the passengers and the little bag thing where you're mm-hmm. trying to... I just think those are all very, very clever and very well thought out. So, I don't think there was anything in this game that was just thrown to the side and was like a bad mechanic, personally. So that would be my buy points. So what about try points for Mystery Express?
I would say the fact it's a deduction game, not everyone goes for that sort of thing. And like you mentioned, this is kind of the next step up from Clue. There can actually be a little bit of brain burn if you approach it a certain way. I mean, you can really just kind of drive yourself crazy trying to remember things and trying to, did I see that card? Did I not see that card? A lot of people could be turned off by it. And I think another possible try point is there can be, it can get a little tedious, maybe. I mean, I think the turns move quickly enough to where it doesn't get too tedious, but there is a little bit of, there can be a little bit of analysis paralysis in there, you know, and every turn is pretty similar. So if you don't like the game from the beginning, nothing's really going to change. You know, it's if you don't buy in the beginning and really like it, then you're probably just going to be bored for an hour and a half.
Hmm. I agree. Yeah, it's basically an hour and a half of the same kind of turns, even though there's those little things that break it up, the time cards and that kind of stuff. But the basic mechanics are the same throughout the whole game. I think they're really cool, but I can sort of see how, you know, someone who's not into that might be a drag after a while.
Mm-hmm.
I did notice that as everybody got similar pieces of information, like in the lounge where you have to reveal, you know, everybody has to reveal one card of the same type.
Mm-hmm.
that, for example, if we all revealed at that in that moment and found out that the club car was not the location, like we saw the pair of cards, you know. Well, now, every time someone gets a club car and they're forced to give a card, that's what they're going to give, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, and that's part of the strategy of the game, I guess. But towards the end, you feel like you feel like you get more information, I think, at the beginning than at the end, mm-hmm. because you've already learned quite a bit by the end of the game. So the last couple of turns, you're trying to get cards, you're trying to get information, but you end up seeing the same things over and over again because people know, your opponents know what they can give you to not give you really any information. So that might be a little bit of a frustration, but other than that, that's about it. How about deny points?
If I had to say any, I could see people really getting turned off by kind of the end game where there's a lot of chance for ties, and I know they have the telegram tiebreaker, which I think is really clever. I think that's kind of a cool way to do it. But, you know, when we played, I won my game. I won the game we played, and I won it pretty much by making – it was an educated guess, but it was still a 50-50 shot of what I had, and it was just a total guess, and I won off of that. I could see some people really getting turned off by that. And, you know, I mentioned this in the try points, but – you know, if you really don't like deduction games, this will not change your mind. This will probably even put you further in that column. And I guess the one other thing is, I don't know if this was just the game we played or what. This seemed a little more complex and a little bit harder to grasp than the other Days of Wonder games. It may have been just the singular occurrence. I'm not sure, but
might have been your game explainer.
No. It's not that. But this one seemed harder to get my head around. You know, about halfway through, I finally got it. But I don't know. It may be a one-time thing that might be something to ignore. But this one seemed a little harder to grasp.
You know, I don't actually really have any deny points for this game. I mean, other than the fact that if you're someone who doesn't like deduction games, mm-hmm. then stay far, far away because it is a deduction game.
Yeah.
But as far as the merits of the game itself and how it's put together, I don't have any deny points for it. I think it's a good game.
I do want to throw out this warning. I think this is one where it's hard to judge it on one play. I think you're really going to need to get it to the table a few times to really get an informed opinion on it. If you can play it at a con, if you can get it through something like GameShare, if you're on the fence, play it a few times because, you know, after we played the first time, I was like, I don't know if I like this game. I really need to play it more, but I think this is one that's going to be a good addition to your library. You know, Days of Wonder is like Looney Labs, in my opinion. They really haven't put a game out there that I just totally hate. You know, I would have every Days of Wonder game in my collection, and this is one of them.
Yep. I feel the same way, and I told you earlier in the episode that I, after playing through this, I went ahead and purchased this game. I'd done it through the game share, and I purchased it from Myriad, and I think it's great, and I think that it's a good gateway. It's a good gateway for people that you know are kind of thinky people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have someone who thinks that Clue is the hardest game that they play, don't have them play Mystery Express. But for folks that are interested in that deduction aspect and, you know, have played Clue, it makes it accessible. It's so... and I think Days of Wonder is really good at these kinds of games where, you know, have you played this? Well, then try this. You know, yep. Have you played this? Well, try Ticket to Ride. Have you played this? Well, then try Cleopatra. And, you know, you can say that about a lot of these sort of games from Days of Wonder. And Mystery Express is, if you like Clue and if you like that element of it at all, I think you're going to find this to be a really rich game experience. So I thought it was really good.
All right.
Okay, well, that's Mystery Express.
There it is.
The train has arrived at the station.
It did not disappoint. It was a little different than I thought it might be when it came into the station, if you will.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Very nice.
But I think I'm going to buy another ticket on this train.
Oh, my gosh.
Look at that.
Very good. Thank you. Are you ready to close the show out
there,
conductor?
That's gameonbox@gmail.com.
Okay. let's close out the show. Or a plastic dresser. Well, thank you as always for listening to another episode of Game On with Cody and John. We love doing it for you. And we've got another great show coming up in 2 weeks. 2 weeks this time. We're not going to push
it out. That's
right.
We're back on the schedule now.
Back on the schedule, yeah. The vacation's all over.
Yep. Vacation time is over. And we're going to talk about some young novices trying to go on vacation. You see what I did there?
It's very
nice. Kind of steered it into it.
Oh my gosh, you're amazing.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about Nuns on the Run.
It's a bad habit, I know.
Oh my
Hey,
goodness.
Thank you.
The new board game from Mayfair Games about naughty novices dodging discovery. That's the subtitle there.
Alliteration catch.
Yeah, so we'll have a lot of other great stuff to talk about, but until next time.
Game on.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games, on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 4138-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows at pulpgamer.com. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On!